Hello and welcome to In the Art Scene podcast, an art podcast that has it all. I'm your host, Galina Marquez, and I invite fascinating people to talk about their personal creative journeys, success stories, and inspiration. We talk about art business and marketing, how to find your creative voice, and all the new trends in the art world, like NFT, AI, and such. Join me and my guest for today's conversation. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to In the Art Scene podcast. I have a legend with me today. I mean, seriously, this woman has a Wikipedia page. And if you don't believe me, go to the show notes and I'll put the link down there for everyone to read it. So I have with me today, Corinne Whitaker, a digital artist based in California in Carmel. She is a pioneer I'm not exaggerating. She is a pioneer of digital art and digital sculpture in the United States. I mean, she's been there when all this thing was just birthing out of nowhere and going along with the evolution of technology, making absolutely mind-blowing work. And I mean, come on, we have a legend here. Let's just give her a round of applause. I hope my editor will find a sound effect to put here for the round of applause. But welcome, Corinne. Please introduce yourself in a couple of words.
I don't recognize that person that you described, although I'd like to meet her. But I'm very fortunate. I'm curious. I love learning, as you do. I've seen that. And the world of the unknown, the world of tomorrow, has always beckoned to me. It's always where I want to go. And so in that spirit, this is how all of this digital stuff got started. It actually began for all of us in the mid-1970s. NASA sent an unmanned satellite to the moon and brought back black and white images that the camera saw out there. And then they constructed a huge sphere, and they took these black and white images and they pasted them all over the interior of that sphere so that they could step into it and see what the camera was seeing and see what was out there. And that is a profound alteration in humanity's view of itself, because we used to have the Renaissance perspective. You know, we were the center, the important thing, and we looked out at everything out there, but it all started with us. When we looked at these images from the camera on the moon, we suddenly realized that we were not that important at all. We were not the center of anything. We were this tiny little speck in a huge cosmos. And the importance of that understanding cannot be underestimated. Carl Sagan produced a video about it called The Blue Dot. And it expresses this change in the view of ourselves. From that came all of the digital stuff that we are using and doing and seeing and developing now. It was a really profound moment in art history as well. It doesn't mean that Renaissance perspective is no longer valid. It's beautiful and valid in its own context. But we now have a different view of ourselves and our place in the universe. And that's a startling change. The other thing that evolved from that was that everything that we do that involves technology or a computer or a cell phone comes from only two symbols, a zero and a one. We have an English language that has, 26 symbols. Mm-hmm. But the binary language that the computer is based on has only two symbols, a zero and a one. Everything that we do comes from that. That's an extraordinary achievement.
Yeah, it's hard to comprehend, actually.
It is very hard to comprehend. And if you look at with just a zero and a one, it blows my mind. So you have a species, humanity, that is capable of great discoveries. You also have a species that seems to be addicted to war. How do you reconcile those two? And those two factors are very much in my work, my art, and my writing. We're a puzzling group, humans. We don't seem to work together very well. And yet we've done some extraordinary things. So here we are.
Yeah. And for all of you who are listening, we started this conversation before I hit recording, talking about climate change, because we have rescheduled this interview at least a couple times because of some devastating weather in California, both in Carmel and San Diego. Corinne experienced some extreme conditions when, you know, they stayed for several days without power and the area was completely flooded. So yeah, we can see the results of our work here. You made a really great comparison that we're a bad Airbnb tenant on the planet Earth. Airbnb. I really like that. I want to make sure that stays on the episode. Yeah.
Well, I, you know, we live by narratives, by stories. In terms of the United States, for example, we have lost control of our narrative. We have moved away from being a melting pot. And instead, we have these warring factions that is tearing us apart. What I would like to see is the human species having a narrative, having a story that pulls us all together. We are all human. We all love our families and our children. And I would like, you know, this is something that politicians understand, the importance of the story, the narrative. Entertainers understand it. But I think that we as human beings have to build a narrative of peace and a narrative of joining together if we are to survive. We're at a point where it's entirely possible that we may not survive. I know that's hard to comprehend and to accept. It's a truth that came home to us when the atomic bomb was first discovered. And we're at that point with artificial intelligence right now. It's not going away. It's here. You know, and to use an old expression, the horse is out of the barn. Here and it's going to be here more. And what are we going to do with it? How do we develop it for good and to help ourselves and each other rather than for evil purposes? And I think the people that have been at the basis of developing the algorithms have suddenly, if not before, become aware of that. What have we done here? Well, and how do we look at it and put appropriate controls on it?
Yeah, we've been warned for decades in movies and literature about what's coming. So we still didn't stop.
No. But see, we could accept that because that was fantasy. This is not fantasy anymore. This is real. This is here.
Yeah.
And we have a responsibility. Coming. What?
The Skynet from Terminator movie. Evil AI is taking over the world.
Yeah. we really have to find a way to work together as a species. There's an interesting book out by a Japanese philosopher. It was just recently translated into English. It's called Isonomia and the Origins of Philosophy. And what he does is to look at democracy and ask, what is it and where does it start? And according to him, most people think it started in Athens. But in fact, according to him, it did not. It started at another community, a Greek community called Ionia. And they developed this concept of democracy in which if there was a lot of conflict, you simply moved to another piece of land and set up your belief system there. And there was land available to do that. We don't have that land in order to spread democracy. We have a lot of people who want, many of whom want to live in the same places. This is a huge problem. These are people who are frightened, afraid of all kinds of terrors in their own countries. Of course, they want to go where it's safer. How do we accommodate them into the world society? And we're not handling it very well. There are no easy answers.
Yeah. Well, on that note, That's getting heavy on Saturday morning, you know.
All right, let's go back to art.
Yeah, let's talk about art. So when did you, I know that you majored in photography, right? And you have been a photographer for a while before you became a digital artist. And I wanted to hear about your journey, how you transitioned from photography to being a digital artist. And I know that you actually specify the medium as digital painting and digital sculpture. And I would really love for you to explain to our listeners what you mean by that and maybe describe your work for someone who hasn't seen it themselves yet.
There are a lot of questions there. I was doing black and white fine art photography. And my method was always to be sure I understood the camera and I was in control of the camera rather than the other way around. So when I moved from single lens reflex, which are little tiny images, into medium format and bought a Hasselblad, I took 6 months off from doing any photography in order to get to know the camera so that it could do what I wanted. The kind of joke of that is I was ready to start photographing again. Somebody was watching me one day and said, "Your light meter's upside down." And I said, "It doesn't make any difference. It's doing what I want, and that's what counts." In terms of moving into the computer, this was the very beginning of color photography. And it bothered me. I love color, but it bothered me because I could extract the color and still have a valid image, which said to me, the color is external. It's not an integral part of the image. That's not true today, of course. But anyway, this is what was on my mind when I wandered into a Tandy store one day. Tandy became Radio Shack. And there was this little black box, and there were these colors dancing around on it. And I was absolutely fascinated, and it disappeared, and something else came up, and I grabbed the salesman and said, "I want that one back. How do I get it?" And he said, "I don't have the faintest idea. This just came in. I don't know how to use it." Well, that was the Apple IIe. And I was immediately seduced. I thought, I've got to have one of these. So I bought one. And imagine if you can, you have this little black box in front of you. You have a keyboard. You have a printer that hardly ever worked. And that's it. You had no icons. You had no mouse. You had no manuals. And you had no programs. You certainly had no art programs. You did have one early program called The Source, which allowed you to type and connect with other people. So I would spend hours. I'd be up half the night because I'd be typing messages to somewhere, usually on the East Coast, and waiting for a response. And we had at that time something called batch transmission, which meant that all of your sentences went up to a satellite, and the other person's sentences went up to a satellite, and they got mixed up. And what came back to you was a weird combination of half of what they said and half of what you said. And then somebody figured out that if you hit something, I'm not sure this is accurate, but it was something like Command G. If you hit Command G or whatever it was, a bell would ring on the other person's computer to indicate that you had stopped typing. So this is how we learned. We learned from each other. And it was just a fascinating, absolutely fabulous time. Because I love knowledge. I've always been interested in tomorrow. What's around the corner? I'm excited about tomorrow. And so this is what kept drawing me farther and farther into the computer. It was a fun time.
Well, that's actually fascinating because when I first was introduced to a computer, we already had modems. I started on PC, so we had Windows. We had some programs. I think there was a very basic program that's called Paint that did pretty much nothing.
That's right. Yes.
Right. But at least it was something. Right. At least it was something. So how from there? You realize that you can use technology to make art.
It was a slow and somewhat painful process. When art programs finally came in, I bought one and I kept it under the desk and wouldn't let myself open it until I was convinced that I was controlling the computer. The computer wasn't controlling me. And so I began, when we finally were able to do a little sketching, I began by doing hundreds of just scribbles. And I would do them first with my dominant hand, and then I would do hundreds of them with my weaker hand, and then start comparing them and saying, what is the difference? Can you see the difference? And what I was learning was to see digitally. Part of the growth of an artist is to learn to see. It takes a long time. And I have said to people, well, people will say to me, when will you stop making art on the computer? And my answer is always, when the magic stops. And the magic never stops. I mean, it's like almost daily. It's like, oh my gosh, look what's there. Look what's happening. I need more of that. I want more of that. I gave a lecture in 1994 at the LA County Museum of Art. And it was the first lecture that they'd had on anything digital. And I called it, look, Ma, no paintbrush. And it was meant to express this sense of wonder. And that sense of wonder is still there. It's what, you know, it's what grabs me every day. I wake up in the morning and think, oh, I want to try this, or I want to try that. Or something often unexpected will happen. And one of the marks of a, how do I put this, a professional artist, let's say, is that when an accident happens, you don't get upset and say, oh my God, what did I do? But you say, wow, how did that happen? Can I do that again? And then you're off on another journey. With the advent, oh, you asked me why digital painting and digital sculpture. There were no names for these things when I started. And to me, the act of painting was the act of making a mark, using your hand to make a mark. Whether you used a stick or a toothbrush or a computer. So I called it digital painting. And there were a lot of discussions about just what exactly it should be called. Same thing with digital sculpture. In the beginning, I used Apple computers after that first Apple IIe. I used them for like 17 years. And at that time, the Apple computers did not have parallel processing or multitasking. And so I was always pushing to try and create in 3D. So I finally got an image in 3D and I asked the computer to render it. And it took 48 hours and your computer was down. You couldn't use it. At the end of 48 hours, I got a message, your computer's frozen and I had nothing. It was at, and this is not true of Apple now, obviously, it's a beautiful computer. But at that point, I switched from Apple to the PC. And I pretty much have stayed with the PC ever since. I have an Apple tablet, which I use occasionally for art. In fact, with the very, very, I think it was the second tablet that came out, I did, it was the world's first fine art series, using this crude camera that was on that early tablet. And I produced a series. I used myself as a model. I did took a very crude selfie. I've used myself as a model for, you know, 45 years. I'm available, I'm cheerful, and I'm cheap. So I don't have to worry about
that's amazing.
going out and getting a model. But what I did was I produced a series called No More War. And it turned out to be four small books. And I used myself, a selfie, and then developed it on the computer. And it was so, the only word I can think of was brutal. I looked at those images because I have very strong feelings about war. I looked at those images and thought, I can't even look at these. I certainly can't show them to anybody. And it took me about 6 months to be able to show them to a group of artists that I, we had an art critique group that I was a, one of the founding members of, and they had the same reaction. You can't show these to anybody. These are brutal. Well, eventually, of course, I not only showed them, I put them into four books, and it was a learning process because you have to learn to divorce yourself from the images that you're producing. You have to step back and say, that's not me anymore. That is an entirely other entity, and it has its own existence and lives its own life. It's an important lesson for an artist. When you're first starting out as a young artist, and for a long time, it's very difficult to show your work because, to put it crudely, your guts are on the wall. You know, the things that you deeply feel are out there on the wall to be seen by others and to be critiqued by others. And as an artist, you have to learn to detach yourself from that. It's not an easy thing to learn. I will always say to young artists, put your work up on the wall. Live with it. Be surrounded by it. Learn about yourself by looking at your work. In my case, the work I do is experimental. It's not comfortable. It's not easy. And that's okay. But other people will see things in it that I have never seen. And I'm thrilled. To me, a work of art really doesn't exist. It's kind of half asleep until somebody interacts with it, sees it, looks at it, feels, thinks. And what you want is some kind of response. If it's a really strong negative response, that's okay. You have evoked something. What you don't want is boredom. But if you can evoke something in the viewer, because the viewer brings a lifetime of experiences. They're not your experiences. When you add those experiences to the work of art, then you have a new work of art, and it's alive. And in that sense, the audience or the viewer is part creator of the piece. So I call, when you work with experimental stuff the way I do, and some of it's pretty complex and pretty difficult, when somebody responds, you call it barking in the dark. You bark in the dark and you hope somebody will bark back. And it's a beautiful moment. I had a big solo show last year at the Monterey Museum of Art. And there was a review in the Monterey Weekly. And this reviewer who identified themselves, I don't know if it's a man or woman, but they were identified only by initials, they got it. They barked back. And the language that they used was so intuitive and understanding, it really startled me. I tried for a long time to try and find out who that person was, and I finally saw a masthead. I saw those initials, and I emailed them. I didn't get a response, and I didn't expect one. But I just emailed them basically to say, thank you for barking back. But this is like what it's like when you do experimental work. You know, a lot of times people don't get it. Or what I will find is that people get stuff that I did 5 years ago. And that's okay. It's just the way the process is. But you have to... how do I describe it? I talk about three pieces of software that are essential, and they are hand, head, and heart. And hand means you have to learn your craft. You have to spend a long time learning how to do what you do. And head means you have to say something. You have to have something to say, because otherwise, whether you're using a pencil or a computer, excuse me, I had a drink of water. It's not going to be meaningful. And heart means that you have to believe passionately, deeply in what you're doing. I had a man write to me a couple of decades ago. What's the name of the software that I use to create the sculpture? Because his daughter is an artist and he wants to learn it so she doesn't have to, and he can make it easier for her. And the question is, how do I tell this man that he is robbing his daughter of the ability to learn to see and to find ways to express what she sees? He can't do it for her. It was a very, I don't remember what I answered him, but it was a very difficult email to write. He was crowding her and keeping her from progressing and learning. Well, this is part of the process of being an artist, is to learn to see. I've been learning to see for 45 years and I'm still learning.
Yeah. Well, I have two questions right now. So I wanted to follow up on that exhibition that you had in Monterey. I hope that you have a clipping of that review in the Monterey Daily. And you can share it with us so I can put it in the show notes, because I'm really curious And I think the listeners will be very curious to read the review that you just described as, you know, barking back that someone got it and someone, you know, had the appropriate response to the show. It would be really fascinating to read. And another question I have is when you started your journey as a digital artist, so back in the 80s, early 90s, and in 94 when you had a lecture at the LA Museum of Art, how many other artists do you think were exploring the same field? Because obviously digital art wasn't as popular as it is now. I mean, I called you a pioneer at the beginning for a reason, but I kind of want to have a sense of how big or small that movement was at the beginning, and if you were in the know or in communication with other people who were developing this field along with you.
There were a relative few. They were spread around the world. There was not a great deal of communication at that time. When I opened, I first opened a gallery in Carmel when I first moved here. And it was fascinating. Nobody knew what digital art was. And so I would have developers coming in, because at the time I was using Macs, Apple Macintosh computers, and they were changing them like every 6 months. And in order to keep up, I would have to keep getting a new computer. So developers would come in to see what these new computers were and how they worked and how, you know, what you could do with them. And sometimes software engineers would come into the gallery and look and say, oh my God, I had no idea you could do this with our software. Well, I had a luxury that they did not. They were being pressured to come up with the next successful product, software, to sell. I had the luxury of taking their software apart and looking into it and working with it deeply and developing it. And so talking to people like that was absolutely fascinating. I loved having the gallery. What I have now is not a gallery. It's a studio. It's tucked away. It's only open by appointment, and you have to wear a mask. You know, it's a totally different world. But the gallery was very exciting. The two things that came to mind were when families came in, and the parents were baffled by the work, and the kids got it immediately. They'd say to their parents, hey, this is easy. Look at this stuff. And they were all excited, and I found that beautiful. The other thing that I remember is there was a group of, you mentioned Russia. My family comes originally from Russia. Nice. And they came to the east coast of this country. They didn't speak a word of English. My grandfather went door to door with a big sack full of things that he was selling. And people would say, do you have this or do you have that? The only English he learned was look in the bag. And that's how my family got started on the East Coast. Well, when I had the gallery, first of all, I wanted a name that reflected digital, but that also was catchy. And I came up with Digital Giraffe. I have no idea where that came from. Afterwards, I looked back and said, oh, wait a minute. Giraffes are, they stand taller and they see farther than others. They are peace-loving. They're vegetarian. They have big hearts. I mean, it made sense in hindsight, 2020 hindsight. But at the time, it was, you know, it was just an intuition. Well, there was a group of Russian tourists that came year after year, and they would literally fly into the United States, get on a bus, come to California and to Carmel, and end up at my studio. And at my gallery, and it was a fairly small gallery. They would sit on the floor. They didn't speak any English. They would be sketching, and they had a translator, and they would ask all kinds of questions, and she would ask me and answer the questions. These were beautiful experiences. I valued those moments because we were able to share feelings without necessarily sharing, or without at all sharing any language. And you can, by extrapolation, think of the world that we live in, where we assume that the dominant language is a verbal language that humans speak. And in our case, we have the hubris to think that English is the dominant language, where of course it's not. But there are creatures around us, like birds have their own language. And we don't speak bird language. Plants have a beautiful language. If you set two plants apart, say 6 feet apart, and watch them, they will gradually grow together until they are touching. It's a beautiful thing to see. So there are many, many valid languages out there that we don't understand, we don't always value. And that gets us into communication, which is a whole other a whole other topic. I don't know if I answered your question, but I tend to work and think this way. In terms of work, there are two, for many, there are two extremes. As an artist, you can be an architect where you have an assignment. Your job is to design a dormitory for students in Siberia, where the weather is this and the climate is that and the electricity is this. You have a goal. Someone like myself, I have no goal. I have to start with an empty tablet every time and just let it go, let it rip. And it's a difficult process to learn because you're letting this stuff go and sometimes it's like, wait a minute, what? And you can't do that. You just have to let it come out. At some point, your experience will step in and say, okay, this is not a useful direction that you've taken. Back off. That tension between totally letting go in your experienced eye is behind everything that I do. And it shows itself in the work. The work has a lot of tension. There's a tension between beauty, or what is commonly called beauty, and our lives as human beings, which are very complex and layered and often painful. Now, I don't know if I answered your question, but well, you got me started.
that's the whole point. You did, and thank you so much. Hey, In the Arts Scene listeners, I just wanted to say a quick thank you for all the support you've given me in the past year. It means more than you know. Every donation through Buy Me a Coffee and every purchase of swag helps me keep up with the production and put out a new episode every week. And I certainly appreciate if you will keep doing it. But I also feel that if you like the show this much, you deserve a little more than just a thank you. This is why I launched a Patreon page. There will be monthly live Q&As, exclusive content, and for the hardcore fans, I got some swag and keepsakes. I love this community that we are building together, and by joining my Patreon, you will help me create more content for you. Go to patreon.com/inthe art scene and join today. It's a beautiful segue to my next question, because I was going to ask you about Digital Giraffe, which now is a monthly digital media outlet, right? So it's a digital magazine, practically. So
it's an e-zine, right?
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about Digital Giraffe and tell people where to sign up to get your monthly emails?
Okay, I opened the gallery, and it needed a name, which was Digital Giraffe. And all of a sudden, domains became available. What was a domain? None of us knew. I didn't know, but I wanted one. It was digital, and it was new. So I signed up for giraffe.com. Then I had long conversations with the people that I work with. I tend to work with for a long, long time. They are people that I trust and respect, and they give the same gift back to me. And I love working this way. So I met a man here. Actually, I met his wife on the beach and mentioned that, you know, I was doing digital stuff. And, oh, my husband does this. Her husband and I and she have become very, very close friends. He's a software engineer. And so we had these long conversations about, okay, you're going to put something up on this thing called the web. What's it going to be? And should it be more data or more graphics? And of course, for me, it was supposed to be all graphics. And for him as an engineer, no, it's the data that counts. So there were these long conversations back and forth. And of course, it had to be both. But the first e-zine that I put up was fairly small and tentative. I still have some of it online. on giraffe.com, you go into the contents, there's an archives section. And in those archives, you will see some of the early, not all of them, because they have not all maintained their integrity, but some of the early issues of giraffe.com. What I've tried to do, to me, it is very important, there's a sense of integrity in the Digital Giraffe Online. I don't charge anything. I don't ask for passwords. I don't collect your data. I don't allow any advertising, because it's about education for me. And it's a sharing. As I educate myself, I want to share this with other people. And the e-zine has grown hugely. It's almost more than one person can do right now. And we are now running about over 1.5 million hits a year, which is really extraordinary. Wow. And I hear from people, and they share ideas, and they make suggestions, and it's just become a wonderful vehicle, but oh my, it's a lot of work. Anyway, on giraffe.com, in the contents, you will always find an article called, under the writing section, you will find Electronic Quill, which is an article that I write every month. Occasionally, there's a guest author, but almost all of mine. And they're archived on the archive section. You'll find in the writing section the newsletter. The newsletter developed because one of my mentors, who was a very brilliant professor of international economics at UT Dallas, he said to me, I need to get, because the e-zine was growing organically. And he said, I need to get something from you that gives me a hint as to what the new things are that you've put up. So I started this newsletter, and the newsletter goes out immediately right after publication, uploading the new issue to people that have asked to get the early notices. And then it's kept online for people that want to use it to lead themselves into the easing, because there's so much stuff there. I spend hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours researching the stuff that goes into giraffe.com. So I've given myself a task, 6 new images every month, 1 on the cover and 5 in a section called digital paintings, and 4 more for what I call blobs. Years ago, there was an art critic for the New York Times, and he was looking at architecture and writing about it. And somebody said to him, you're missing what's going on. You're looking at all these rectangular glass and brass buildings, and that's not where architecture's going. And he suddenly realized that architecture was changing, and he called them blobs. And I think he was probably looking at some of the early work of Frank Gehry. But the word blob stayed with me. So I have used that for another section where I put up 4 blobs each month. And these are very, very early, usually, 3D models, when we were just learning. We've just had the capacity to design in 3D. And that designing in 3D is a different language. You can be adept in painting and drawing and sketching, but you're not going to automatically and easily move over to working in 3D. It's another language. And that was a whole fascinating development, just as AI is another fascinating development. I don't know where I got here, but anyway, I was trying to answer something that you asked.
Okay. We were talking about digital giraffe. You're good, absolutely. Just to please continue. Well,
this is the way I work. I just let it go. Anyway, the article that was in the paper, I have it printed out in my studio. I also have it online. So when we end this podcast, I will send you the link to it. Yes. Where people can find it online. It was beautifully written, and it was, you know, he said something, he or she, something about delving into the electric folds of the brain. It was so beautifully expressed. But I'll send you the link to it after we hang up.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I put everything in the show notes so people can go to my website and find the links. And then from there, they can go and visit you and whatever, all the references that we're talking about will be there as well.
If they want to get the early notice newsletter, then just email me, giraffe@giraffe.com, and tell me you'd like to get the newsletter early, because I only send it to people who have requested it.
And I can attest that it's worth it. So just go to your computers right now and send an email to Corinne at giraffe@giraffe.com. Because I get my email regularly, and I'm really happy to receive it. And I also follow Corinne on LinkedIn, which is a very interesting choice of social media for an artist. I know there are some artists on LinkedIn, and I am discovering different groups right now. A lot of it is kind of a business related. So I am really pleased to see how active you are on the platform. And it is actually very unusual, because normally artists are like, for a lot of artists, Instagram is kind of a social media of choice because it's so visual. But I love that you are using LinkedIn as a platform, because you provide a lot of educational content, and that's probably the best place to be with such content.
Well, you have understood why I chose it. I tend to avoid social media. There is so much harm done, and hurtful and harmful things are not my place in life. But as an experimental artist, it struck me that LinkedIn was a different outlet, and it felt more professional. And so initially, that's why I went there. One other thing I wanted to mention that you didn't bring up, but it's very important to me. Many, many, many years ago, I noticed that galleries and museums had nothing about African art, African tribal art. And so my tendency is always to say, why not? So I started to study it and found it profoundly beautiful. And in the process, started modestly collecting African tribal art, masks primarily. And at some point I was asked by Dominique de Menil, who had a really extensive and beautiful collection, to write a program for Rice University on African tribal art. So I wrote this program, and I taught it to groups of docents. And the idea was that they were to go out into the community and awaken students to something that they were not aware of. So all of the docents signed up for the white private schools, which is not what I had in mind. We had a section of Houston that was known as the murder capital of Houston. This was Texas, remind you, in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. I went to the murder capital. I went to these schools that had never had a visitor come to the classrooms before. I went into classrooms where the teachers, both black and white, were telling the kids, you're nobody and you'll never be anybody, so you might as well accept it. And then I walk in there, and I would always bring a mask with me, and I would let the kids try them on, and then I would talk to them about this beautiful, extraordinary heritage that they came from, that they had ancestors to be proud of, and they should partake of this and realize how important they are and their heritage is. I never had a bit of a problem. Those kids gave me so much love. This has been an extraordinary moment in my life. I've never forgotten it. There was one kid about 12 years old, and I just finished writing an article about this that'll go up as the Quill article in June. It's called Bridgerton, This Is Not. This kid was 12 years old and gifted. Oh, my goodness, the drawings that he did were just beautiful. And Houston was holding a citywide competition, art competition for students. And so I pushed him to enter. And he entered his work, and he won a prize, and they never invited him to the ceremony. And I was outraged. No, this was Houston in the 70s.
Wow.
I had clients. I would make reservations to take my clients to cafes and restaurants for breakfast. They wouldn't let me in. These are for men only. Anyway, I called City Hall in Houston and raised a ruckus. And eventually, they sent him a certificate. Of course, he never got to partake of the ceremony, but at least he got the certificate. I'm sure he doesn't remember my name, and I unfortunately don't remember him, but that experience with those children has remained with me throughout my life and has taught me so much about understanding that there are others who are just as beautiful as we think we are. There are many ways of describing the world and living the world in terms of African art or music, for example. There was a tradition in tribal music, and you can try this yourself. Take your dominant hand and beat out waltz time on one leg. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. Take your other hand and on the other leg, beat out 2-4 time. One, two, one, two, one, two. Now try and do them both at the same time. I can't do it. We can't do it. But this is how African tribal dancers move their bodies, with their legs to one rhythm and their shoulders to another and their hips to another. We can't do it, but they could. And it is a beautiful way of expressing feelings about the world. So I would also do this with the kids. And I've done this since with adults too, trying to explain that there's a big world out there if we just open our hearts to it.
Yeah, this is amazing. And in preparation for this episode, I wasn't aware of your advocate work. And that's actually beautiful to hear that for so many years, you have been such a voice for African-American art and culture and their heritage. And this is the one thing that kind of a bittersweet that came out of the pandemic, with the unfortunate events that were happening a couple years ago, at least we had some, much more people were starting to notice and open their eyes, and a lot of African American artists actually raised their voices and were heard. And this is difficult for me to talk about because, first of all, I didn't grow up in the United States, so and I am kind of learning about all of this as I go. And I am a white woman, from a totally different background. So that whole concept, like I empathize, but I can't really put words in the proper way, and I really don't want to be judged, and I don't want people to think that I am insensitive, because I am, but just don't know how to express it. I am actually thinking for a while about bringing more African American artists to the podcast and talk about it. I it's because I want to be educated on this as well. Because everything I see from the angle that, the angle that African Americans are having is never going to be available for me. I will never be able to see it from their point of view, just because I have a different background. But that doesn't mean that I can't try. So yeah, right. It is really beautiful to hear that you are such a huge advocate from the times when it was almost completely impossible to be an advocate for such things, and you stayed the course.
Well, I love people. I think what you expressed was very beautifully expressed. It is painful to see what is still going on. It's shameful. It's more than shameful. And the fact that it is still happening and that so much of it is hidden away is very difficult to see. In the case of the experience that I had back in Houston, the woman that got in touch with me, Dominique Dumanil, had an extensive and very beautiful collection of African art. And these pieces were viewed as primitive in the worst sense of the word, and a craft. And in fact, they came from a very deep spiritual understanding of the world. They were meaningful in the lives of the people creating them. Anyway, she finally got the Museum of Modern Art in New York to accept a donation of her pieces. And even then, for years, they were treated as ethnographic or crude. They really weren't fine art. The museum wasn't comfortable with them. It took a long time for it to be recognized as a valid, you know, way of making art and expressing the world. Dominique de Menil was a very interesting woman, a controversial figure. She bought a piece of sculpture by Barnett Newman called the Obelisk, and she donated it to the city, and they accepted it, and they put it in front of City Hall. And the history of this is on my website. But anyway, she put it in front of City Hall, but what she didn't tell them was that she put a plaque on it. And the plaque said, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Mm. And of course, she's a very courageous woman. Of course, they forced her to take that plaque down. And so I did eventually, when I got into, we haven't talked about this at all, but 3D printing is a relatively new manufacturing technique, which is more and more taking over the manufacturing sector. And I have a whole section on it in giraffe.com. If you look in the sculpture section, you'll see 3D print news. And mm-hmm. every month I will put up links to the new stuff that's being done. And it's just, it's extraordinary what's happening. But anyway, I did some of the first large life-sized sculptures of human beings in 3D printing. One of them was called Alien Incoming, which is this figure perched at an impossible angle, looking down at the planet Earth and saying, forgive them, for they know not what they do. It came from this experience that I had with her. Another one that was very important to me was a life-sized 3D printed sculpture of a black male. And it was important to me for a lot of reasons. First of all, the black skin is exquisite, is beautiful. There were no sculptures that I knew of honoring black men. There were sports figures, but they were always covered with uniforms, since they were quasi-Caucasian, but nothing that specifically said, this is a black male and he's beautiful. And so that's what that sculpture meant to me. I did a woman also, same size, Eve, and she is actually the color of the earth. And there's a little piece of her material on the leg of the Adam sculpture to say that she came first. Mm-hmm. And then he was made from her rib. It's just kind of an insider joke. But anyway, Adam and Eve were shown at the museum at the show there, and they're in my studio in Carmel.
That's wonderful. If you have a photo, I would love to put it in the show notes as well.
Yeah. Oh, I've got them. They're online. I'll send you.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Send you links to them.
Absolutely. So that's actually another wonderful segue. I don't know how you do this, but that's a segue to my next question, because I wanted to ask you about the production of your work, because, you know, digital art, as we know it today, you know, because we're interacting with our screens more than we're interacting with live people, I guess, we see a lot of art online in different forms, produced digitally or scanned and NFT, which is not a hype anymore, and I'm really glad about it. But yeah, I have my own problems with it, but it's okay. You mentioned that you have a gallery, so it kind of creates, you know, a little bit of a confusion, digital art and the physical gallery. And I want you to talk a little bit about how you reproduce and display your work, because I was fortunate and privileged to be a part of the production of one of your series. And I had
I loved working with you.
It was an
extraordinary
experience.
To work with.
Thank you so much. It was an extraordinary experience, and I was really happy that I could actually add something to it with my own hands and my own interpretation of what the assignment was. but mm-hmm. our listeners don't know about it. And I want you to just talk in general about how you represent your work, how you display it, and in the physical form.
Hold on a second, because I'm going to drink some water.
Okay.
Okay. When I first started with digital imaging, it seemed to me there were two choices. You either did only one of each piece, or you did millions and you dropped them off of a helicopter over Tokyo. But in between made no sense to me. You know, it's one or the other. Midway just made no sense. So I decided, okay, I'm only going to do one. So each piece is a unique piece. I don't have the gallery anymore. I have the studio, which is different because it's open only by appointment. But it is filled with all kinds of digital imaging. And one of the processes that you had to go through as a digital artist was, how do you get your work out there? And it was a difficult process. And you and I both worked with a man that I loved working with. I think I was his first customer. We worked together for over 30 years. But he had an approach that I valued and still value, which was he was open to experimentation. And so for the 30 some odd years that we worked together, he would let me know when he found a new process that maybe I could work with. I would let him know when I came up with an idea. And working together that way was a really beautiful experience. His man was very good at what he did. So I went through all kinds of experimental processes. I did some of the first images on aluminum. And then when we tried brass, and then we did brass and aluminum together. And I tried copper, which immediately didn't work. It was interesting. Copper has a strong visual voice, and it fought any kind of image that you tried to put on it. Whereas aluminum, for example, has a very yielding presence, and it's more compatible with images put on it. And then I got into glass, and I love glass. I have always adored glass. When I'm reborn, it's going to be as a glass blower. Mm-hmm. But anyway, then I got into mirrors, which were important to me because it mirrored ourselves in the image. So it drew the viewer into the image and made them part of it. So the material that you work with, especially when you're an experimenter, as I am, is an important part of what you do. And you're always going into the unknown. You don't know exactly what's going to happen, particularly with 3D printing, for example. When I started with 3D printing, and again, it was, you know, what is this? How do I do it? And I found myself working 100% with men and with mechanical engineers who were courageous enough to move into this new manufacturing process. But these men saw the world in terms of edges and rectangles and squares. I saw the world in terms of organic forms and curves. The biggest problem was, how do we talk to each other? How do I make them see what I'm trying to do rather than what they see? And it was an interesting and difficult process, but you had to establish that communication or they wouldn't be producing your work. They'd be producing their own. And so one of the first men I worked with, an absolutely wonderful man, did this piece called Big Beautiful Woman. And not only did he not understand it, he literally couldn't see it. And so when he brought the piece to my studio, his son, the 16-year-old son, was with him. And he was honest enough to say, I can't see this piece. And his son said, Dad, it's simple. He's telling you that women are not built like Barbie. They're not sticks and bones. You know, they have wrinkles. They have folds. That's what makes them real. That's what she's calling Big Beautiful Woman. He got it right away. He understood. It reminded me of the Benin bronze sculptures, again, in Africa, in Nigeria, mm-hmm. Where the women were shown with wrinkles on their necks. And these had a symbolic meaning. It meant that their husbands were wealthy enough to feed them well. There was another American artist named Thomas Hart Benton who taught anatomical drawing. And he said, I want to see the bumps and hollows of human bodies. I don't want to see sticks. Well, Big Beautiful Woman is meant to show the bumps and hollows of real bodies. Anyway, the point of all this was that establishing a form of communication so that your vision can be communicated to other people is one of the big jobs you have, as certainly as a digital artist. What I'm dealing with right now, and I'm going to stop and take a drink of water, excuse me, with artificial intelligence. Again, it's a new tool. There are a lot of problems with it. There are already lawsuits that have been filed because artists feel that their work is being stolen.
Yeah.
I think the thing to remember, once you put something up on the internet, once you send an email, you no longer own it. You no longer have any control over it. It is no longer private. And it is naive to think that you have any privacy or any control over it. Now, we as human beings tried to give some protection to intellectual property with copyright. And we said, okay, copyright exists for this number of years and you can't copy it. That has become moot with AI. AI is based on literally billions of images that are out there. And AI scrapes these images daily, minute by minute. You can't stop that anymore. And so it's going to take a while before the lawyers and the jurists understand how to build protections into this. In the meantime, you know, you might as well tell artists, you might as well tell the sun not to shine. Artists are going to use it. So I use it extensively. I started using it years ago. I started trying to, I composed music using AI. And what struck me immediately was that the algorithms were all based on Western music. And so this struck me as egotistical. There's lots of music in the world. There's beautiful music that doesn't come from Western culture. Why aren't those being used? And then I went into lyrics, writing lyrics using AI. And again, they were based on hip hop, which is exciting and wonderful. But there are lots of other ways of expressing things in words than hip hop. And so this was my experience. And then I got into AI and I used myself again as the model. And I started running it through AI, and the stuff that came out was like, what? I was seeing myself, and at that time it was absolutely startling. I was seeing myself as an old man, as a baby, as twin. What's going on here? As twins. So the potential with AI is just extraordinary. I am so involved in it now that I wake up in the morning just, I can't wait to get to the computer. I want to do this and I want to try that. And it's like, oh, I can learn this and I can learn that. And it's just a whole new world that's opened up. So join me and look at some of these really weird things that are coming out of this new AI experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everything I could link to the show notes, I will. Absolutely. And I think, I think, you know, this show notes are going to be like way, you know, the list is going to be pretty extensive. So you guys brace yourselves. Don't skip a link. Please click all of them.
I will try and send you a bunch of them to the places that you want to go. And if I've left something out, I, you know, just let me know.
Absolutely.
And if you ever find anything, if you ever find anything that you think is appropriate for giraffe.com, because it is a gift to the world. It is my gift to the world. It's the world's gift to me because I learned so much in doing the research for it. But people will tell me, have you looked at this or have you looked at that? And I love it. And I will put up on the website, thanks to so-and-so, just with initials, because people want their privacy. For leading me to this. I get wonderful ideas from other people, and I love when that happens. Anyway, thank you for the broadcast, for the podcast today. Well, I am much more used to writing than I am speaking, so I don't know how this came out.
It's going to be a wonderful episode. Thank you so much for your time. I'm so grateful, and I feel so privileged having you on the show. It's been an amazing hour. Thank you so much, Corinne.
Well, I am so proud of you, and it really has been a joy working with you. Good luck to you and stay well.
Thank you so much, and we'll see you again in the art scene. It has been another episode of In the Art Scene podcast. If you liked today's conversation, please give us a good review on Apple. and go listen to other great stories. Check out our website intheartscene.com or follow us on Instagram at intheartscene for more content. If you are a creative and you want to share your story, shoot us a message from the website or DM us on Instagram. Look forward to seeing you next time in the art scene.